Welcome back to the Long Distance Love Bombs podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, and today's guest is a fascinating and enlightening human being. His name is Andrew Frazier. This dude is a yoga instructor. He is a coach. He is a skydiving instructor. He runs a climbing gym in Denver, Colorado. He is just amazing. For much of this episode, I'm simply sitting there with my jaw open, listening to him tell stories about all the things that he's done. And we get on a little bit of a wild tangent when he mentions that he was a student at Columbine High School during the mass shooting event. And we kind of unpack that in a really powerful way. And he discusses his trauma and how he healed from that and sort of the subconscious programming that he had to learn to accept and to understand and to utilize in order to facilitate healing. There are vivid and somewhat graphic descriptions, so take that as a trigger warning. Though I must say, we get into some really fun stuff. We talk about bungee jumping, we talk about skydiving, we talk about facing your fear and how to actually feel that in your body to focus on those feelings and transform them into freedom. You're gonna love this episode. This dude is just so interesting. I really enjoyed talking to him. And he also has a special if you're listening to this episode where he's going to offer you free coaching. And you can find that in the show notes. Book an introductory call. Talk to this dude about pushing your edge, getting out to face your fears. A wild conversation indeed. Enjoy. All right, brother. So we are going to talk about base jumping, anxiety-inducing pursuits, fear, overcoming fear, kicking ass, living a bold life, etc.
Love it.
Does that sum you up a little bit?
Don't tempt me with a good time.
So Andrew Frazier, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, man. It's like to be here.
Yeah, super pumped to chat with you. And admittedly, just being transparent, I know absolutely very little about you. You were recommended to me by a mutual friend, Trevor Bohm, and he said, yo, you have got to talk to this dude. And I was like, okay, done. And here we are. But you are a base jumper, a yoga teacher, a wild man, a mountain climber, and a coach. Why don't you answer that, actually? For those that don't know you, like, and for me as well, like, Andrew Frazier, who are you? What do you do? What are you passionate about?
Yeah, it's funny. If you were to ask me that question in any given year, I would have a different answer for you over the course of the last 20 years. I've worn a lot of hats. And most recently, my main gig is I'm the director of a local climbing gym in Denver, Colorado. So we're a huge indoor climbing and fitness facility. Mm-hmm. So by day, I'm sailing that ship. But I've also been a longtime yoga instructor. On the weekends, I moonlight as a skydive instructor, and I also am a storyteller and a coach. So, again, it depends on the day of the week, but you'll find me doing any of the above.
I love that, man. And so, just out of curiosity, what are some other hats that you've worn through the years?
Oh, man. Everything from the manual labor back in the days of, like, pushing a lawnmower, doing landscaping, building houses, repairing sprinklers, spent a good stint around the world as a camp counselor, ski school instructor, guiding college and like youth study abroad programs. So kind of bounce. I also, unlike the dark night of the soul, I was also selling speakers out of a white van in parking lots. So like I've done many different pursuits. Some just to pay the bills, others, you know, to like ride thrill.
Yeah. You've been around the block.
Yeah.
It's good, man. And so you are a part-time skydiving instructor / base jumper. I'm very intrigued to hear more about that because I'm a little bit scared of heights and I've never actually had an extended conversation with somebody that pursues fear at such a level regularly.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, it may actually shock you or listeners to know that I'm also a little bit afraid of heights, which seems super oxymoronic.
Yeah.
I think my my foray into that world began about 20 years when I first got 20 years ago when I first got into rock climbing, and living in a mountain town in southwestern Colorado during college, I had some buddies take me and expose me to the outdoors, and bit by bit kind of pushed the envelope in terms of my own comfort level and what I was willing to take on. So outside of climbing, though, I've always had a long aspiration to fly, and it's not unlike a lot of, you know, young kids who look up at the birds and aspire to do the same. But I think what's unique is that I also had a couple decades worth of really lucid dreams about flying, and dreams in which I would actually evolve in my progression and ability to fly and perform. So it became this like really visceral pull towards experiencing flight in real life. So
hang on. So just to clarify that, you like dreamed a lot about flying, and then in your dreams you got better and better at flying?
Yeah, it was wild. I recall as early as 6 years old having dreams being in my old childhood house. I could climb up on the back of the couch, jump off, kind of flap my arms, and get a little lift before like belly slide into the kitchen. And then later, junior high, high school, I'd be outside of that house, could run down the street, get some more airtime up and over a house or two before I'd run out of steam, come down. And by end of high school and college, I could literally like take a couple steps and soar across the Grand Canyon, and not only like get this kick-ass airtime, but also feel and understand aerodynamics of flight in the dream, where I understood, like, I could feel the wind on my body. I understood how like the tilt of my head or a dip of my shoulder would actually change my trajectory. So I was actually getting better at it. And it was never just like this fluke experience. I would wake up feeling really empowered by these dreams and with like a crystal clear recollection of them, because they were actually, it wasn't just a faint memory of this thing that may have happened the night before. It was a really lucid and participatory experience.
Okay. And so what did you make of that at the time, or as that was happening? Was it just like fun and cool, or was it like, I'm just like, that's weird to me. Like, that's super cool and super weird. Like, I've never heard of somebody that gets better flying over decades in their dreams.
Yeah. I've always been a really, like, and within my family, there's been this long history of like very vivid dreamers. And so I suppose I inherited that trait, and would journal my dreams for a long time. And by college, I actually started researching the skill of lucid dreaming. And there's a lot of really cool research behind that about ways in which you can start to facilitate and increase the likelihood of becoming lucid in your dreams, and then start to navigate that world with the actual presence and clarity inside the dream. So for me, it was just like, you know, I've always been an explorer in many ways, whether that's like literally venturing out in the Colorado Rockies, or as a deviant juvenile exploring altered states through hallucinogens. And so the dream world was another opportunity for me as an onironaut, which is like an explorer of the dream world, to start kind of venturing into these distant lands and seeing what I could create in the process. And then take the memory of that, the experience, the new sense of agency, like out into my life, and say like, cool, what will I make of this now? Like, what if my waking life were just as malleable as this dreamscape that I just navigated?
Yeah. Awesome. I'm just like, yeah, keep talking, man. Like, okay. So you have these dreams, and then how did you use them in your present day experience? Like, did you make your life more malleable? What did it teach you about life and living?
There were, you know, while I've had a lot of really cool experiences in the dream life of breathing underwater and walking up walls and all the, you know, the fantasy land stuff, the two most potent outcomes that I got from really delving into this world of lucid dreaming was one, realizing my waking life dream of flights, which came later in the form of becoming a skydiver and flying a wingsuit. And the first time I jumped out of a plane, I actually had the recollection of what it was like in the dream world. And no shit, the first thought as I spread my nylon wings, you know, flying above Colorado was, oh yeah, I've been here before. Like, this is familiar. And that was a phenomenal ride. So really empowering on that aspect. But another thing that I had learned about in my studies of lucid dreaming was the opportunity to leverage the dream world for a form of like self-therapy or treatment, you know, dealing with trauma. And I'd read about these other people who would maybe have these crippling phobias of, say, snakes, and then they'd be guided to try to create these scenarios in their dreams wherein they could like walk around the snake and then eventually touch the snake and then find a sense of comfort with it, and they would experience it in their real life too. And so the biggest breakthrough for me was that back in 1999, I was a student at the Columbine High School, at Columbine High School when the shooting happened. And unfortunately nowadays, you know, active shooter situations are far too common, but back then, like, it was a pretty big deal and the largest of its time. So I was, as a student, 17-year-old kid that day, like, I ran for my life. I lost classmates and friends and neighbors. Like, I was gutted by that experience. And while that's a lot to unpack about that particular event, one after effect of that, or maybe a symptom of one of the expressions of like PTSD that I experienced, was recurring nightmares. For about 8 years, I would, on average, every 3 months or so, I'd have a pretty pretty paralyzing dream about being in a public situation where an active shooter situation would break out, and I would typically always end up running away from that shooter, and the dream would end either with me just running, gasping, you know, for air, or sometimes being shot in the back and bleeding out. And, you know, talk about waking up in like a pool of my own sweat, feeling traumatized and devastated. Like, it was really hard to go through the better part of a decade reliving these. And so once I dove into the world, I started to ask myself, like, is there a way that I could actually find a sense of agency in these dreams or become lucid when one of these things rears its head again and take the power back? And that is what actually happened. Is I had a dream in college in which similar situation, I'm in a public place, a guy's sitting at a like a cafeteria table, pulls out a gun, looks like he's about to commit suicide in front of himself or in front of the crowd, and I'm, you know, appalled. And then he has a change of heart and starts shooting up the place. So the scenario plays out the same way. And as I'm running down a hallway, I have the epiphany. So I become lucid in the dream. I go, damn it, I'm so tired of running. Man, like, so tired of running. I was exhausted by that experience of being disempowered and afraid. And for the first time in this series of dreams, I actually paused, and instead of just running for my own life, I started going into adjacent rooms and clearing other people out and ushering them towards the doors. And as I came to these double doors exiting the building, again, this is in the dream, the gunman was coming around the corner with a hostage, you know, arm around his neck, gun to their head, and he's chasing the rest of us. And as I bust out these doors in the dream, I find a six shooter lying on the ground, and I open the chamber. There's two left in it. And I realize what I have to do. Now I'm like no hero in real life. I'm not a sharpshooter or anything, but in the dream world, I crouch, await this guy to come out the door. I fire off two shots, clip him, drop him down on the ground. And while he's still alive, I pounce on his back, effectively hogtie the shooter. And the dream ends with like first responders, news trucks, you know, EMS rolling up on the scene. And I'm just like kneeing this guy's back. And I growled. I said, not this time, you son of a bitch. I was so angry. I had so much like pent up like anger and resentment about it. And that the dream ended with me in a place or position of power over the shooter. And ever since I had that dream that ended in that fashion, I've never had another traumatic dream related to that shooting. So it's been just phenomenal to leverage the power of the dream world to then realize like really extraordinary results in my waking life too.
Andrew, what the fuck, man? wow. And so after that, you never had another dream in that.
No, it's been like over a decade and I've had zero shooting dreams.
And like when you woke up that morning after having that experience, how did you feel? Like, was it different?
Yeah, man, it was, there's a major like energetic and emotional release that came with that. I mean, I literally like kind of sat up out of bed and like puffed my chest up a little bit, realizing that I had owned that dream, that I had not just been like the victim of it or at its effect, but in the midst of an otherwise really chaotic situation, I became lucid and then like flipped the script in the middle of it. And so, it's been really, really phenomenal and a way for me to continue exploring this notion of how much am I at the effect of life around me or getting enrolled in this like collective narrative, and how can I otherwise like go to explore these alternate possibilities, whether it's in a state of meditation or sleep, use what I discover there, and then go to like effect some new kick-ass change in my waking world.
I suppose on some level it's evidence of power and evidence of courage and of taking responsibility for what's happening in your own experience. Yeah,
positively.
Yeah, dang. You touched on being a survivor of Columbine. Is that a topic that you want to talk about more here? Or
I'm happy to unpack it. It can certainly go a lot of different ways. So, you know, what might you like to know about it? Because obviously that it can be dissected in a ton of kind of social issue ways, personal experience and otherwise.
Yeah. I don't know. I just feel like you brought that up, and that was obviously a national tragedy. It's going to be in the history books, et cetera. It's a very significant event, obviously in the United States, history, but also in your own personal history. And I feel like it was thrown out there, and I kind of just wanted to flag that as like, well, that's an interesting thing that you lived through and experienced. And I'm sure that there's powerful lessons that arose from that, seeing as you consequently overcame PTSD, had night terrors for nearly a decade. I'm just intrigued basically about anything that you'd like to share about that. I'm conscious of prying too deeply. I don't want to, you know, dig up things you don't want to talk about, but if there are things that you feel like sharing that you learned from it or how you lived and worked through those things.
Yeah, you bet. You know, of course I've unpacked that experience in many, many conversations over many years with many people. And unquestionably it was a major turning point in my life. You know, I was 17 years old at the time, walking into school on a Tuesday in 1999, you know, riffing with buddies about prom the weekend before and the girls we got to make out with, et cetera. And hours later was running out for my life. Never looking at the world the same way again. So it was a major confrontation and pattern interrupt as far as like status quo in Littleton, Colorado, white suburbia, not a care in the world, to holy shit, my next door neighbor just got shot in the head while studying for exams in a library. You know, we've got buddies and other people who had the rug pulled out from under them as 15-year-olds. And so yeah, it was majorly disruptive, of course, and such a shock living in this otherwise like inoculated bubble of middle class white suburbia in Colorado. But for me, upon reflection, I think I observed a couple of ways that people responded to it, because I was a junior at the time and actually had to come back and complete my senior year at the school. And at the time they didn't have the funds to completely remodel the commons in the library where most of the carnage took place. So no shit, there was plywood boarding up the doors of the library, and in this dark, cold hallway still open in the school, you know, that was a very grisly crime scene. So there was no sense of like normalcy after that, trying to go back to school. But
so it's just a perpetual reminder of what was, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it was that really wild juxtaposition of like life was blank before that. And now I'm really clear about why the chair next to me is empty in this class, or it's understood why when a student or a teacher just out of nowhere breaks down in tears in the middle of class and needs to take a break or go home, like there was just a nod of understanding because we were all collectively like really grieving and suffering through that. But what I saw in not only the, like my senior year, but the years that followed was a number of ways that people reacted to that trauma. Some were severely impacted, whether they were in the building or not even at school that day, that felt really paralyzed with fear or would swear that they'd never go back in and they moved to different towns. Others took it up as like as their mantle, and they really became activists in the world of either evangelism or lobbying for better gun control, etc. Some people sadly slid back into the status quo, and I watched them kind of be reabsorbed into their cliques and still be kind of petty. And I was shocked that people could so quickly return to the way that life was. And I personally came out of it with this understanding that I was 17 years old, my sense of invincibility has absolutely been shattered because I just, you know, there's a number of people very close to me that lost their lives that were on really hopeful paths. And so I'm going to get busy. I don't know how long I've got left. I could get to 60. I could get to 35. I don't know if I'm going to see my 21st birthday. I'm going to go out and pursue and taste and experience as much as I can. So upon graduation, I really started delving into what is out there in the world and how much of it can I dance with before I die, because I really have no idea how much longer I've got. You know, you hear these cliche statements of once we have a near-death experience or we lose someone close to us, it causes us to reevaluate our own lives. But that was very real for me in that I did not want to follow the prescribed path of college, career, white picket fence, house, you know, eventual retirement, you know, because I just didn't know that any of that was guaranteed. And I set out to really experience and explore as much of the world as I could in the meantime. And in addition to that, I was clear how much hurt can be caused through pain, through division, through hate. And I just didn't have time for it. Not in the sense of like really hating people. I just didn't even have time for like the petty bullshit or like tapping my foot angrily behind somebody in the checkout line of the grocery store. I didn't have a tolerance for it anymore, because in that same sense of knowing that I don't know how much time is left, I also don't know when or which of my conversations is going to be the last with any given person that I touch. So I kind of came out the other side of that with two conclusions of one, get busy living, because you know, you never know how long. And two, love hard, because you know, being petty or going to bed angry is just a waste of my time and energy.
Get busy living and love hard.
That's it,
dude. I'm like at a loss for even where to go with this. I have so many questions. Have you seen similar like realizations from some of your friends that also experienced that same kind of trauma? Or are you like an outlier in the sense of getting busy living and loving?
I've seen it expressed both ways. And there's actually one outcome that I forgot to mention. And that was not just status quo, but it was that of the victim. I saw a number of friends who really went down a dark road after the fact, in the year or years that followed, like get lost in the bottle in over-the-counter meds and whatever their crutch was. And when confronted about that, Columbine became their cross to bear. So you don't get me, man. Like, you don't know what I've seen. You don't know where I've been. And that became the default strategy to deflect responsibility and to stay entrenched in that sedation, that avoidance, that distraction. And I flirted with that world at times, and I can very much understand how it's easier to numb the pain than it is to sit face to face with it.
And so what was your process then for sitting with the pain? Or I imagine you went to therapy, or what was your healing like after that?
So even in the years following Columbine, I sadly the trend continued where I lost a number of people close to me, both to suicide, and those two suicides, but a best friend and an uncle had taken their lives under the influence of alcohol, so not in a right mind, and also lost some close family members just due to totally unexpected and tragic deaths. For example, my cousin, who was 26 at the time, a best bud and little brother to me, got married, dream wedding on our family lake, and then a month later came home from work, took a shower to wind down while his wife tucked into bed, and she woke up the next morning, he's still in the shower and his heart just stops. I mean, dude had a healthy individual, had a ticking time bomb in his chest that nobody would have ever known. And so so I think this series of exposure to death continued each time to smack me upside the head and reinforce that mantra of get busy living, go out there and do it. But there was a little bit of paradox in the way that I responded to it, because yes, I did go out, I traveled many countries of the world, I pursued extreme sports, I learned new languages, I took on a lot of new experience. But for one, a number of those extreme sports that I pursued also put me right up on the knife's edge of risking my own life. And so there was this balance between going out and trying to seize life and also pursuing these sports that could very easily kill me, perhaps more easily than my daily commute to work. And so looking back at that, I realized that maybe there was a dual purpose served. One, to suck the marrow out of life and just be joyous and feel exuberant. But two, to feel like I had a sense of agency in those situations. You know, they say that sometimes trauma survivors will seek out or recreate experiences in which they're put into a threatening situation so that they can replay that scenario and maybe choose a different ending or, seize control at the end of it. So to some degree, while being in an active shooter situation, I was just running for my life and that everything was out of my control. Conversely, when I would go walk a narrow mountain ridge or jump out of an airplane, yes, there's inherent danger, but I felt a sense of ownership in that if I am to die, it's of my own making, and it's not because somebody else caught me by surprise and shot me in the back.
Yeah, you're still in control, right? And that movie Free Solo with Alex Honnold, he talks about, have you seen that film?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, and so he talks about, it's risky and I can die, but it doesn't feel like an out of control dangerous risk because I've trained so much. He feels in control and he's managing the risk, right? It sounds similar to what you're describing here.
Absolutely. But there's another interesting effect that oftentimes hindsight's 20/20, and so I didn't make sense of all this until I finally returned home. But after 4 years of college in Colorado, I went and I spent the better part of 7 years traveling the world. That's when I was doing these wild pursuits, climbing mountains, guiding trips to various countries. But one of the benefits of being so far from home was I didn't have to be with the memory of that. Sometimes people would ask me when are you going to finally come home and ground and settle? You feel like you're running from anything? And I'm like, no, man, I'm just chasing life and seizing it all. Mm-hmm. But only after I returned home and actually dove into a yoga teacher training program did I realize that there was a convenience about the life and lifestyle that I had engineered in traveling the world, because rarely would I be in one place for more than 3 to 5 months at a time. So I could make friends, have these extraordinary experiences, and then get really comfortable with just saying goodbye without having to let them too close to my heart and my vulnerable pieces. And then once I actually came home and had to sit still for a long period of time, I realized that there's a lot of shit that I hadn't dealt with, a lot of pain that I hadn't unpacked, a lot of death and loss that I had not processed. And so long as I was in motion and chasing the next big goal, I didn't have to be with that. And my yoga instructor and mentor at the time actually called me out on it in the midst of this training. She said, Andrew, you have this, I just have to share this. You know, you have this funny way about you in that with one hand, you invite people in, you know, motioning this like come hither gesture. And then with the other, you stop them about 6 inches short of your heart. And you, and so people are stuck in this netherworld where they want to get to know you, they want to get close to you, but you don't quite let them in. And so what I had realized is that I had kind of designed this life for myself wherein I didn't have to get that close to anybody because I was always on the move to somewhere else, or I always had something else to strive for on the horizon. But the impact of that, or the consequence, was that as long as I kept everybody else at arm's length, because I didn't want to see somebody else die. I didn't want to, you know, dive into those deep and painful parts of my own life, was that it was also stifling my self-expression, my creativity, my ability to like be in service to the world. You know, if I were to paint a picture, it's as though my heart was a really soft, fragile, space that had been wounded deeply and time again. And so as a protective mechanism, I started to like build a little wall around that to make sure and keep the threats out. And over time, as I kept reinforcing and building that wall higher and higher, it got really dark in there. And like, I couldn't see the sun anymore and people weren't allowed access to me. Like, not only was I keeping out the thieves, the bandits and the bad guys of the world, but like I was keeping out the people who wanted to serve me, who wanted access to my joy, my creative spirit, you know, my medicine. So I inadvertently like created a boundary between myself and the world that was designed to protect me, but actually had the reverse effect of keeping everyone else at bay, such that I actually couldn't be out in service to these people that I really loved and cared about.
This idea that our weaknesses or our strengths turned up too high, right? So
yeah.
So it's a really powerful, beautiful thing that you're subconsciously trying to protect yourself from pain and trauma and suffering, right? And that's normal and natural and in some ways, you know, a protective mechanism. But then you turn that thing up too high, and as you say, you're suddenly alone in a fortress of your own design with no genuine human connection at a really profound level. But then the consequence of that, of course, is that you don't risk losing that person who you've connected with at that genuine vulnerable level. The subconscious sabotage, huh?
Absolutely. So yoga ended up being a really powerful vehicle for me, or arguably one of the most potent forms of therapy over a course of years, unpacking that trauma, what it felt like to be with pain, the work that it took to literally like crack my rib cage open and let people see me and actually allow them in as well. And it was extraordinary because it actually came in the form of a lot of the asana or the postures. You know, there's dharma or there's themes that can be shared throughout this, but I found there was almost a reverse psychological effect in expressing these poses. You know, if you see a person with chin down, arms crossed, you might infer that they're closed to your idea, or maybe they're insecure and guarded, et cetera. And so our body language reflects our emotional state. And what I started to find through yoga was that the more I was physically training my body to open up and like lift my collarbones and express, it actually started to shift my state such that I was more receptive and open to allowing people into my life. So it's been an extraordinary form of medicine and healing at the cellular level that has created access to a lot more deep connection that was not available when I just kept myself like really guarded.
And you seem to have a really high self-awareness about yourself and how you feel and how you operate and the things you do. I'm curious, was that always around, or is this just a product of doing the work, so to speak, of going to therapy, doing yoga? It's like learned.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to your point about therapy is I've only gone to a handful of sessions. There were a couple of free counseling sessions offered to the Columbine community after that shooting. Took a handful of them and I didn't get a lot of benefit from it. What you know, so what I found was, one, even at, you know, as a pot smoking like misfit 15-year-old, I got into personal development at a really early age. So I've always been an avid reader, and as a young teen, cracked open my first like self-help book, and have for the subsequent two decades had that as my prime genre of study, is always looking at ways to better understand myself, the human brain, human behavior, and ways to manipulate these aspects so as to engineer the life that I desire. So from an intellectual level, I've been an avid reader for a long time and exploring these ideas. In the last 10 years, both yoga and meditation had a really profound effect. As I described with the asana or the postures, moving energy literally in my body, and then meditation and sitting still with both physical discomfort and enough silence and space held that I could hear that internal narrative. That's, I think, what has generated a lot more of this awareness for me. I did years ago, a 10-day Vipassana meditation retreat. And at this retreat, we committed to a vow of noble silence, which meant not only zipping my lips for that period of time, but not reading books, not journaling, not listening to music, no phone calls, no eye contact with the other participants there. So given a little bit of basic instruction, but otherwise sitting still for many hours a day with my own physical discomfort, as well as all of the story running through there. And so I think that has helped me to identify the correlation between, you know, the narrative that's spinning between my ears and also how that feels in my body. And to be able to start to flex one or the other in order to achieve the state that I want, whether that's more relaxed physical being before I'm walking up on stage to give a talk, or if that's to shift my internal state or my narrative such that I don't get so enrolled in like a victim or sob story or place of disempowerment.
What is your current meditation practice? Do you have like a specific routine that you do every day, or a certain style that you're drawn to?
I've explored a lot of different ones, and right now it's pretty basic in the form of waking up in the morning, doing about 15 minutes of yoga just to warm the body, and then sitting on a cushion or a block for 10 to 20 minutes, and really just not chanting a mantra, not doing specific breath work, but sitting in this space of observation and noting how frequently other thoughts will interject, or I'll get stuck in a pattern or starting to entertain some other thought loop. And really, that's been the value for me, because I think those who don't meditate or say I can't meditate, or they're intimidated by the idea, what's important to know is that even after a decade of doing this, like, it's usually pretty fucking noisy in there. You know, like, I'm bald, but I'm not this like enlightened bald dude sitting on a cloud during my meditation sessions, just like channeling the divine. Most of the time, I'm having a lot of overlapping conversations, and the challenge and the opportunity in that seated meditation is to note when the thought has come in, and not to actually fight or force or fix it, but just to allow it to pass through, and then to return to that state of stillness or equanimity, which for those who aren't familiar with that term, to be equanimous is to sit in this state of non-attachment, where I'm neither trying to cling to the good feelings and thoughts, nor trying to push out the harmful ones, but essentially returning to this affirmation that this too shall pass, and just trying to sit in that stillness. And if in a 10-minute seated meditation, I might only experience 45 seconds of that true emptiness, but most of the time, like, it's a lot of noisy interruption, and the practice over and over is just coming back to that place.
Yeah, I totally agree, man. For me, it's been the biggest game changer that I've experienced. Like, the thing that if I had a time machine, I could go back and talk to 20-year-old party animal Jer, be like, bro, like, meditate every day. like start doing it. And I think one of the biggest misconceptions from people that don't do it is that there's just like this Zen-like quality that to those who do, and it's peace and love and light and unicorn farts and all of that. And like the reality is, at least from my own experience, is that it's more about reminding myself that I am a crazed lunatic in my mind, and reminding myself to not necessarily trust my thoughts and my stories and even my beliefs, because I listen so intently to the nonsense that that brain creates on a daily basis. It's a subtle reminder to me that like I'm insane. And also that I get to consciously decide what I want to focus on, and I get to choose the stories that I tell myself about life.
That's it. You know? And you know, what I share with those learning to or aspiring to meditate is, and I'll sometimes drop these little nuggets in teaching yoga, is that it's not about achieving this totally blissed out state of emptiness, but it is trying to locate yourself as the witness to your experience, you know, to become the observer rather than the one on stage. And I know that might sound like kind of woo-woo or meta for certain people, but those are the most peaceful moments that I experience, is when it's almost a zoom out of my body and consciousness. And I realize I am not actually the one having the conversation about money, stress, or relationship issues. Like, that's a conversation that's happening within this cognitive space. I'm actually the witness to it. And it's in those moments of knowing myself as the witness that I then feel much more grounded, peaceful, and at ease. It's the difference between being like the observer of the play or the one acting out the melodrama right on stage.
Yeah, I heard it described as, this may have been my friend Holiday Phillips, who I also interviewed on the podcast a while ago, but something along the lines of, in therapy, you pay somebody to listen to you, and in meditation, like, you just listen to you.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a kind of self-therapy where you just listen to your nonsense. And so there's both the listening and honoring what does come up, and then also having that sort of conscious choice to let it pass, as you say, like clouds in the sky, and then going back to your breath or whatever it is you're trying to focus upon.
Yeah. You know, and the ROI for any of these practices, whether yoga or meditation, I believe is not in the 10 minutes of bliss that you may or may not experience sitting on a cushion. It's actually applying it in your daily life when there's high stakes, when it's having that moment of awareness, when you're about to say something in a tense situation that you're later going to regret and have to clean up. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell my yoga students often, I go, like, I've been teaching them for about 10 years now. And so, I kind of bust their chops a little bit. I've got a little more personality than when I first began and tried to be like really, enlightened and devout.
Yeah.
And,
like what you thought a yoga teacher should be.
Oh yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Tone of voice and rehashing roommate quotes and everything. And I'll just like, I won't drop F-bombs, but I will, you know, tell people to inhale, lift their rib cage, exhale, fix their face. Like, y'all are taking this too seriously.
Yeah.
But I will, I'll tell my students frequently, guys, I don't care how strong your warrior pose looks. Doesn't really interest me whether or not you can hold a handstand. If you leave class and you flip off the first guy who cuts you off in rush hour traffic, yoga is not working as it could be in your life. You know, it's not about leaving your practice on this little island of a mat. It's about weaving that thread of it through your life out in the world. And I still find it in these moments where I'm driving through a sketchy part of town, and I recognize, I can feel my shoulders creeping up by my ears, and my chest starts to tighten, and I have to remind myself, woosah, shake it out, you know, like, so I'm more present to the physiological sensations that occur as a result of my environment or these thought patterns that I'm in, and gifted with that awareness, then the opportunity is to create a state change physically or like through a new internal dialogue.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit, just going back to what we were talking about previously, the chasing of the near-death adventure and the managing risk and controlling all of that. It sounds almost like that you're pursuing these two ends of the spectrum, right? Of, I'm going to go out and jump out of airplanes and climb mountains and whatever else that you do that we haven't talked about. And at the same time, I'm just going to sit here and quietly breathe. And that's going to be the way that I approach trauma or my life. It's quite fascinating.
Yeah. And you know, that's kind of how the work that I'm currently doing has unfolded, because while I might get kicks going out and pursuing some of these, extreme pursuits, I'm not necessarily inviting others to do the same. However, I can speak to my experience, stepping at, you know, to the literal edge of a 3,000 foot cliff, the fear that consumes my body before contemplating jumping, and how a daily person could experience that same amount of fear just before they get up to the mic, you know, at a slam poetry night, or before giving their pitch to the board, or like telling that person that they've been dating for a while, like, I think you're the one. Like, that's been the real benefit for me. Is, and it's kind of a misnomer for those who think extreme athletes are just adrenaline junkies, thrill seekers. Like, we've all got mohawks, burning couches, like, you know, chanting anarchy on the weekends. Like, I'm a dude with a desk job. I used to be a fourth grade teacher, and I've done some extreme shit. But what has been a benefit of pursuing some of these really wild endeavors is that I don't go at it from a place of, I'm trying to get my fix and like feel that juice flowing through my body. In fact, if I were to step to the edge of a cliff before jumping off with a parachute, and my adrenaline was coursing through my veins, I'm actually likely not to be the best decision maker, and I'm not going to perform as well as I could coming from and borrowing from this experience of being a mindful meditator and yoga practitioner, where I can actually recognize the physical sensation, the potentially paralyzing fear in my body, consciously, intentionally breathe, move through that, and then, you know, have the volition and the sense of control to take a leap, not from a place of recklessness, but from a place of self-knowing. Like, yeah, I've got this. Yeah, I've done it. You know, done a thousand skydives before. Yes, I triple check my parachute. And so that's what I'd love to share with people, is helping them navigate the complex neuro-linguistic world, or otherwise the way that they can get wrapped up in their own story that might keep them out of action, helping them feel into their body when they're physically gripped with anxiety or a reluctance to take that next step into something that might be really impactful and calling to them and keeping them awake at night, and then also coaxing them into taking the next practical, tactical step that's not going to kill them.
Mm. Yeah, it's all a practice, right? And yeah. I think what you're speaking to is identifying the difference between fear and danger.
Yeah.
Right? Like, fear is cool. That's fine. No big deal. Like, we got it. It's okay. Danger is a very different beast, right? And you talked on Instagram recently, perhaps you can tell this story, but when you were climbing up the Matterhorn. So actually, maybe this is a good segue, man. Let's talk about some crazy shit that you've done. So you just very off the cuff threw out that you've done 1,000 skydives. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yes, about 1,500 these days.
So you've jumped out of a plane 1,500 times.
Yep.
You base jump. Actually, going back to that, is it still terrifying when you jump out of the plane? Like, do you ever get fully used to it?
I feel pretty comfortable jumping out of a plane, in that I've got a little bit of insurance in the form of two parachutes. Base jumping, you only get one, and typically a lot less altitude to jump from. So it's literally do or die.
So hang on. So you do like 1,500 skydives, and then you're like, nah, it's not quite doing it for me anymore. Like, I need to up the ante. Like, let's try base jumping. Or how do you get into that?
So this is kind of wild. Going back to the dream world, I had not only these dreams of flights, but I would also have I had a recurring dream over the years of a really big and ominous mountain that had like a sheer dark face, and somehow I would be way up on the face of this peak, and I would, in whatever manifestation of the dream, fall off of it. And in the dream, I would be, you know, pitching into the abyss and always wake up just before I hit. And that was another thing that kind of haunted my dreams. And
does it happen? So on the one,
well, what's really fascinating is now looking back, it appears that my recollection of the dream looks very much like the Eiger, which is in Switzerland, the big North Face, which is like a notorious mountaineer's test piece. And that's the mountain that I later returned to and jumped off of with my wingsuit. And so, again, as an expression of a dream or an idea or a concept that continued to haunt me for a long time, I wanted to own that, not to live out, you know, my own death, but to actually revisit that experience of a huge, ominous goal that I didn't understand at the time and that really frightened me, and to actually turn that fear of dying into flying, you know, to like death. Instead of just like finishing the dream just before hitting the ground, I actually finished the dream soaring out, you know, in over the green landscape and landing in a field of wildflowers, cows ringing bells on their neck. I mean, I cried my eyes out when I landed from that jump. So skydiving was, and it still remains a real passion for me, and it was a necessary step on the road to this ultimate dream of climbing a mountain under my own power, stepping to the literal edge of it, launching off and flying back down to safe ground where I began.
Just, yeah, keep going, man. Like, so you, just for those listening who are, maybe can you talk about the difference between a wingsuit and base jumping? Just so we're super clear as to exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, I appreciate the clarification, because oftentimes the moment that I say that I fly a wingsuit, or many people call them squirrel suits, their mind instantly goes to like the YouTube sizzle reel of dudes proximity flying 100 plus miles an hour, 6 feet above the ground in these alpine valleys. That's not my game. Wingsuit flying is one discipline of skydiving. So you can jump out of a plane, fall like a rock to the ground, you can do formations on your belly, you can do this freestyle flying, or you can actually strap yourself into a nylon suit that has wings between arms and legs that creates more surface area and lift, so that instead of falling straight towards the ground, you now effectively are flying across it and getting a glide of about 3 feet forward for every foot that you fall. So I actually do experience a sense of flight, and typically do that out of airplanes. Base jumping is an acronym that refers to the four types of objects a person would jump off with a parachute. B is building, A is an antenna, like a big radio tower. S is span or a bridge, and E is earth, like a big cliff. So in base jumping, somebody would use a parachute to jump off any one of those objects and land on the ground. Some people have married those two worlds, jumping off of large cliffs, base jumping with a wingsuit, such that they climb the mountain, jump off, and then actually do experience flight before still opening a parachute and landing back on the ground.
And you said a few moments ago that you climbed up the mountain. So you're doing like rock climbing or just hiking up a trail?
Yeah, while there are a lot of rock climbing routes straight up the north face of the Eiger, I chose a different route up the northwest ridge, which could be hiked and scrambled with the assistance of a couple of fixed ropes. So still a pretty technical ascent, but it was that combination of climbing this beast under my own power and then being able to jump back off it.
Okay, and so what is it like to base jump versus skydiving? I've never done either. So skydiving sounds to me like very scary, but you have a backup chute, as you said.
That's correct.
Base jumping to me sounds like times a million, holy crap, what am I doing?
Yeah, we often refer to base jumping as skydiving's badass older brother. Yeah, because skydiving is exhilarating and still has a little bit bigger margin of safety. The best way I could describe it is, if you've never jumped before, but you've driven down the highway and stuck your hand out the car window going fast, you feel that sense of air pressure on your body. It's actually similar when jumping out of a plane. It's not typically that roller coaster gut in your throat feeling so much as it is a lot of wind on your body and resting on a cushion of air. Most people actually don't experience the sense of falling while skydiving so much as floating with a ton of noise and wind in your hair, because you're typically a couple miles above the ground and you don't have the reference point of the earth rushing up at you like you would if you were to step off of a high dive into a swimming pool.
Right.
Base jumping, conversely, you're typically jumping off of a fixed object, whether that's a bridge, a building, a cliff. And so unlike skydiving where you're hopping out of a moving plane and instantly feel that wind on your chest, with base jumping, you're exiting into dead air. So it is that imagining stepping off a 10-meter high dive or cliff jump, and any amount of motion you do in the first couple seconds won't actually change your trajectory because there's no air pressure before reaching that terminal velocity. Mm. So you may be kind of rolling up the windows and you do experience the stomach in your throat going over the roller coaster kind of feeling. So it's scary as hell, especially if you're only a couple hundred feet off the ground. Skydiving, I would jump from an airplane at 13,000 feet, open my parachute at 4,000 feet, and have several minutes of canopy flight before landing. On a number of base jumps that I've done, I've only been 200 feet off the ground. And so that's lower than I would typically even open my skydiving parachute, and I haven't even stepped off the edge yet. Mm. So absolutely, that's scary when you can see the ground rushing up at you like that.
It sounds more synonymous to like bungee jumping type of experience where you can see the ground come. That I have done in Zambia, and that was scary because you can see the thing coming closer and closer and closer and closer.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a good comparison. So if you stomached bungee jumping, then you might be more capable than you give yourself credit for.
Thank you. I will receive that. But that was one reason I wanted to do it, is because it terrified me, man. I sat in this creek or this riverbed for maybe a half an hour watching the bridge above me and just on repeat, watching them jump, get rescued, go back at the top, watching them jump. And finally I analyzed it enough where I was like, okay, I think I can do this. But then of course, as you know, like getting up there and actually doing it is a very different ball game.
Yeah, of course. And could I ask what your process looked like? I know that you're a doctor and a scientist, and so did you take a purely intellectual approach to, like, did you Google like the breaking strength of the elastic cord and do all this, or did you give yourself like a Tony Robbins pep talk? Like, what was your process from sitting on the sidelines analyzing, just saying, "Fuck it, here we go"?
Yeah, it was kind of like I'm sort of an observer. Even nowadays, I'll go to a party and I kind of stay on the outskirts and just observe what's happening and kind of take it all in. And so from the perspective of the riverbed, it was like, okay, that person jumped and didn't die, and now they're back on the bridge and everything seems okay. And oh, there's another one, and there's another one. And I was kind of counting like, okay, that's maybe 3 seconds of falling or whatever it was. And then they sit around for maybe 10 in the air. Maybe they each have, 3 to 4 up and downs. And so I was kind of just collecting data. But then when I was up there, and on the very edge, because they do all the little, they've strapped your legs in and they do all the things and they all have their little jokes, where the guy before me, as the dude jumps and then the guy's like, "Oh wait, not yet," and he's, and he's falling. Right. Or they go, "Oh, did you tie him on?" Or things like that. So what I did though, is I jumped far out and I was trying to reach out with my hand and grab a little tiny house on the horizon. So I was like trying to grab this image in the distance, and then eventually I couldn't see that house because my neck was reached so far back, and then I had to look down, and then the terror came.
Okay, got it. And if I could follow that with, being paralyzed, finally committing to the step. Once you ended up in the free fall, got through the first bounce or whatnot, like what was the next emotion that you experienced?
So
So
when you realize you didn't die.
That I didn't die, yeah. So I got to that. I'm like falling. Suddenly there's a pause, a very brief pause, but like a pause of like, and I go, oh shit, like it worked. And I was like, whoo, and it was relief.
Yeah.
Then, however, Andrew, that was immediately followed by the upswing, where now the bungee is stretched like a tight rubber band, and then you go shooting through the air backwards, right? And so then I'm like, oh fuck, again, screaming like, oh fuck. And then there's a moment at the top where there's a pause. And right at that moment, I turned and was looking up at the bridge. And I have a great photograph because I was like throwing up the horns and it was a nice moment. But then it was like, oh shit, I'm going down again. So there's like the up and down and up and down and up and down, which was equal parts terror and relief and terror and relief. And in some ways, a microcosm for life, right? Like, yeah. Oh, I'm terrified. Oh, I didn't die. This is great. I'm amazing. I'm strong. Everything's fine. Oh God. Yeah. I'm scared again. Is this going to work out okay? Oh, it did. Okay. Everything's fine. But back on the bridge for about 20 minutes, 30 minutes, I felt as happy and as blissed out as I've ever felt in my entire life. I recall walking, there's a bridge between Zambia and Zimbabwe, and I had crossed the bridge to get back to where I was supposed to be, and there was a woman that was approaching me. And I remember seeing her coming at me, and I have no recollection of what she actually looked like. She was some local lady. But in my brain, it was like, look how beautiful you are. Wow, hello, human. Like, I feel so connected to you. Gosh, you're glorious. And as she walked by, I was just over the top smile on my face. So happy to be alive. Hello, kind stranger. You know, just being that guy. And yeah. I remember thinking, whoa, like there are so many chemicals that just got dumped into my bloodstream. I feel right. On top of the world.
Yeah, outstanding. And you know, that's what I share with people in my talks and my coaching is that on the other side of our fear oftentimes is a new sense of freedom and perspective, not just the juices flowing and some of the chemical hits that we get from the thrill of it. But walking out the other side or off that bridge, knowing yourself as a new person. Like I would submit that, in traveling the world, had you sat, watched these guys jump, considered, and then ultimately gone home, that there may be a little tinge of regret that still resided in your chest for the next year or decade to come.
100%.
You return and now you got this kick-ass story and you also know yourself as a courageous person who leaned into the unknown. And that now becomes the precedent for how you show up in future situations.
Yes, my identity changed. I was now a person who had bungee jumped in Zambia. And how fucking cool is that? I told myself. Versus when I was sitting at that freaking riverbed going, oh, maybe I should just go home. Maybe I'll come tomorrow. Like, it's a little cloudy. Your brain plays all the tricks to try to subconsciously get you to not do that thing that it perceives as dangerous and out of your comfort zone, etc. And they're very reasonable explanations. I'm like, oh yeah, it is getting late. Or yeah, it is a little bit expensive. Or yeah, I might die. These are very valid excuses, but they're excuses nonetheless, right? And so yeah. I think that, the confrontation of an excuse is a reclamation of power. And I knew that if I faced the excuses, then I would see myself differently and I would have a story to tell and, assuming it all went okay, I would be braver and more adventurous or however I needed to feel, right? But it begins by, I believe, facing the beliefs and the thoughts in your brain and confronting them, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that's a good intro because I know you teach things about fear and focus and overcoming and getting to freedom. So maybe you have some things to add to that.
Yeah. What you were just sharing reminded me of an interview that I heard with Liz Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, Love. And I love and have now adopted her outlook on fear. And what she said was that, we have this kind of macho attitude or relationship with fear in that we paint a picture of it as just like this big beast and we vilify it as this thing that you have to conquer or slay. you know, like, wake up, eat your Wheaties, and punch fear in the face, and I go kick ass for the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. And her take on it was that wasn't actually very helpful, because it kept us always like looking over our shoulder and feeling like there's something we had to go to war with. Mm-hmm. She said, I relate to fear more like a neurotic bodyguard. And in that, I appreciate that fear is looking out for my best interest. You know, like, fear has been hired as this evolutionary tool to keep me alive. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's going to look out for any potential threats that might cut me short. So instead of always acting like I gotta go like slay fear like a dragon, I'm going to appreciate that it's looking around each corner for me and saying, watch out, this car is driving a little too fast, or beware of that sketchy person, or maybe you shouldn't, you know, engage in this next activity. And so I think I love that notion of aligning yourself with fear as opposed to being an adversary, because then you can actually appreciate when it rears its head and says, whoa, like, we should watch out for this. And at times you can say, hey, thanks for looking out, you're right, that's a good call. And other times you can say, look, man, I'm just about to like post my poetry online, you can put the gun down. Mm-hmm. And so I love that notion and helping people to transform their relationship with fear and not have this scary monster that's living under the bed, such that they have to try to build a life that's buffered themselves and protected from it. But instead, that they can actually start to engage in a dance or a dialogue with fear as something that's looking out for our best interests. Like, fear for me is, I love you, Ma, it's my mother's voice. Like, when I'm standing on the edge thinking about that, like, I hear my mother going like, honey, come on, like, there's so much more that you could be doing with your life right now. Have you thought this through? Like, we really, like, and I hear my mom, but rather than being a person to fight, like, I can appreciate the genuine concern and the love that voice comes from. Mm-hmm. Acknowledge that and say, thank you for your contribution. Like, I hear your perspective based on what you know with the information provided. And I'm going to take the next step because I know what I'm capable of. So that's really what I aim to do with my clients, is to help people to identify the big audacious goal that they're going for, whether it's writing a book, launching a business, leaving their current job, or some expression of that, and helping them to understand, one, the number of stories compounded to convince them otherwise, just like you on the bridge, like, maybe today's not the day, I should wait till the economy's stronger, like, I'm gonna put more money in the bank, like, it's already been said, et cetera, I don't have a publisher, to help to dismantle that disempowering narrative first. Mm-hmm. Secondly, to become embodied, so they actually identify what fear feels like in the body and the ways that when gripped, fist clenched, stomach tight, jaw locked, like, I'm actually not a very empowered and rational human being. So I have to shift into a more physically relaxed state so that I can be a calm and thoughtful decision maker. Mm. And then lastly, once shifting the dialogue in the internal state, saying, okay, you aspire to climb Everest, it's probably not a good place to start. Let's take you for a walk in the foothills first. You know, like, let's chunk it out into baby steps. Mm. Because much as I love and listen to some of these guys like Tony Robbins or Les Brown, I don't believe, I think there's only a shelf life for the amount of confidence one gains from listening to like the pump up speech in the morning before going out to charge life. I'm more of the belief that confidence is actually born out of competency, of doing small things over and over thousands of times until we know ourselves capable. Thus, that's why you can confidently get behind the car and drive while making a call and changing the song and eating your to-go, because you've done it so many times, it's no longer a frightening incident. So that's what I aim to do, is really work people through the linguistic, somatic, and strategic processes of helping them to take that proverbial leap in their lives towards the thing that calls to them, like the gravity sucking at their heels off the edge, and also scares the shit out of them.
I love that. And I totally agree. I find that, you know, we associate fear as being this bad thing, right? And if we think it's a bad thing, then we're supposed to avoid it, or we're supposed to punch it in the face. I used to have like a magnet that I sold at markets. It was like, wake up and punch your fears in the face. And like on some level, I do relate to that and agree to that in like a metaphorical sense of overcoming and defeating the fears, so to speak. But at another level, I think what you alluded to was holding them close and feeling them, listening to what they have to say. Because sometimes fear is right. You know, like sometimes there's this intuitive gut whisper that's like, hey, this is maybe not a good decision. And so I think when we do hold it close and we do learn sort of what it feels like, what it sounds like, et cetera, we learn to communicate with it better. And then we get to consciously choose to decide how to use that fear moving forward. Right. And like, I think that you said like, hey, thanks, but like, I'm doing it anyway. Right.
Yeah. Because really, you know, ultimately, if you do relate to your fear as the hypervigilant bodyguard that has been hired to keep you alive, it's actually not in your best interest to go fight that bodyguard who's trying to keep you safe. You can actually appreciate like the work that, you know, Bruce, your bouncer, is doing to keep you safe. And at times, like, put your hand on his shoulder and say, hey, that's cool. Like, I got it. I'm just going to ask this girl on a date. Yeah. Like, there's actually no one to fight in that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm not going to choose to avoid that for a week or a month or a year because of the story I'm telling myself of what it means. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Are there any little hacks or tips or tricks or questions that you use with clients in terms of moving them from a place of fear to a place of freedom?
Yeah. So, well, like you could unpack this in many hours or over the course of a workshop, the kind of three stages that I would walk someone through is, one, define the story. So what is the narrative that's running through your head? Because again, going back to this idea of meditation, self-awareness, most of the time when we say, I am Andrew, I'm a 38-year-old male, I am this profession, that I like, it's coming from a, like, all of those are an accumulation of facts and maybe evidence to try to support what is ultimately a story of my identity. So I would ask people to first question your sense of self and how much of that has been constructed or pulled up from this well of deep knowing, like in the heart space, and how much has actually been adopted from any other sources, such as parents, teachers, society, social media, people saying like, oh no, actually people who look like you don't fly airplanes. People like you aren't fit for the NFL. People like you don't make $1 million building a speaking business. Like, to start to really get clear on where, to do an inventory of the number of places in life where we consume information and to actually start becoming critical consumers of that. And to recognize, like, in every advertisement that I'm exposed to, what is the messaging coming to me and how much have I internalized that such that I have now assumed this form or identity where I'm actually not the kind of guy who could speak on stage like Tony, you know? Or so to one, begin to just be more critical consumers of information, to take an actual inventory of all the places where you are consuming stories or myths throughout the day, whether that's a high school, college textbook, a commercial, a news report, or a social media post, to actually view and appreciate these things from a distance without always accepting them as like the way, the truth, and the light. Secondly, to discipline the state, which means start just paying attention to how your body feels in different situations. I'm not saying you have to take up yoga or sit on a meditation cushion each day, but maybe for 2 minutes, sit in stillness before you head off to work or on your lunch break, and don't try to do anything, accomplish, or go, you know, achieve anything. Just sit and observe and start to notice, just now I was thinking about my ex, like my forehead furrowed and my jaw got really stiff. No shit, there's a physiological reaction to these thoughts I have about my environment, my past. Beginning to get present with what that feels like in our body, so we can start to realize when we're chained by or imprisoned by these physical sensations, because then it becomes a repeating and compounding cycle where if I become the guy that's always walking around guarded, arms across my chest and furrowed brow, I'm not as likely to be the open, receiving, loving person that I say that I want to be. And then lastly, as far as determining a strategy, part three is to really get clear and to maybe write it out and say, right now, what I'm up or starting with, what I aspire to be or do or have is blank. Be a speaker, write a book, start a nonprofit, et cetera. What I'm up to right now is blank. And to, again, do a little inventory. All right, I'm actually, you know, watching Game of Thrones 7 hours a week, in the scroll hole 90 minutes a day. I'm doing all these other things. Start to get honest about whether these present actions and habits are serving that higher aspiration. And if not, following that honest inventory to say, okay, if I aspire to be the person speaking on stage to 5,000, then I will be the type of person that wakes up when my alarm goes off every morning and I'm going to journal for 10 minutes. I am not the type of person who hits snooze 6 times and then pulls out my phone and goes straight to scroll on Instagram. You know, so again, just to kind of to summarize that, one, define the story. Where are you consuming this information? How much of it is owned and self-generated? And is it empowering you if you have really adopted that? Two, start to pay attention to your body and how you feel in different situations and stimulations. And three, begin to create an action plan with baby steps. Don't do like the New Year's resolution thing and try to quit smoking, join a gym, write a book, and find the love of your life by January 15th. Like, people set themselves up for failure by aspiring to too much in too short a time, when they can otherwise start to create a new sense of identity by just implementing small daily habits, such that, you know, to James Clear's credit, the author of Atomic Habits, at the level of identity, they begin to know themselves as, I'm the kind of person who writes every day. I mean, he's got a habit tracker journal, and he says, you want to learn to write? Commit to this for 30 days, write one sentence a day to this prompt. It doesn't matter if you're like cranking out a paragraph a page or more. If you sit down every day at the same time and write a sentence, you can begin to know yourself as the type of person who sits down and writes every day, no matter what. You know, then you start to change at that level of identity, and next thing you know, you are that person stepping up to the proverbial edge of that thing that terrifies you, and you now are equipped with the self-awareness, the skill set, and the capacity to actually take that leap. And then when you land on the other side of it, go, holy shit, I'm a new person. I am not the one who was playing small those weeks, months, or years ago. This is now the baseline for all of my future performance, and that feels outstanding.
Mic drop. Hallelujah. Amen. Encore. I love it, man. What's something for you right now that you're leaning into in terms of an edge?
So as an aspiring storyteller, because that's the way that I learn best, I have been stepping into live storytelling events. If you're familiar with The Moth, it's an event promoted by NPR, in which it's a live storytelling event that happens once a month in various cities. The MC will select a topic, announce it a month before, and you can show up either just as an attendee in the audience, or if you feel like you got a story to tell around that topic, you can put your name in a literal hat and potentially be drawn or called on stage to tell your story in front of about 300 people, like hot mic, hot lights, camera rolling, all that shit. And so I have been challenging myself to go to and actually get on stage at the Moth events and tell my stories, and to do so not just from a place of being well rehearsed and polished and like that young yoga instructor that was trying to be like theatrical, but to be personable, to be relatable, to actually like dance in the conversation with the audience, and to be able to be willing to like wing it a little bit. In my own training and coaching, I've been challenged with a lot of improv. And for me as a dude who likes to be polished and prepared, like to just throw me on a scene and say, now there's a banana in your hand, go. Like, yeah, that's my edge, man. Like, it's as much as I aspire to big things and I'm willing to take a certain amount of risks, I am not above wanting to look good and trying to avoid looking like a doofus in front of a bunch of people. So that's been my edge, is to actually go up there and say, I actually haven't rehearsed this very much. I might have 3 bullet points. I've only got 5 minutes to get it out. Like, lights, camera, action. Here we go. Mm.
How did it feel when at the start of this conversation, I was like, yeah, I don't really know where this is going. I don't have any bullet points. We're just going to roll. Did that trigger you at all? Or were you kind of comfortable with that?
You know, I'll tip my hat to you, Jeremy, because I trust you. And so I know that it takes a good interviewer to facilitate a great conversation. And the quality of my answers are only as good as the quality of the questions that you choose. Mm. So if you and I were to do a live event in front of hundreds of people and say, I don't know what's going to happen, but we got 45 minutes, like, let's pull a keynote out of our ass. Whew, like, my heart would be pumping. But you know, inside of this container, like, I believe you to be an excellent human with a great tribe of people who are in this safe space together. And so stepping into this world felt really comfortable for me, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And just to throw it right back in your face, I feel like I didn't even ask a question like the first 20 minutes. I was just being regaled by wild stories from you, man. So I just do, as we're wrapping up here, I want to thank you for what you're doing in the world. And I just want to just honor you for what you've lived through and what you've overcome and what you've turned it into is hugely inspiring to me and I think very admirable. So thanks for what you do, man. And if you could just take a moment to tell people where they can find you. Like, do you have a book or a TED Talk or anything out there yet?
No, those are both on the to-do list. In fact, the speaking and storytelling program that I'm in is facilitated by a woman who is herself a TED speaker coach, or one who trains others to give TED Talks. So yeah. You bet your ass it's on my bucket list. Man, I just got to figure out something to talk about.
Yeah, gee, I don't know. Is there anything that comes to mind that would be interesting? But like, it's going to happen. So when you give your TED Talk and when you write your book, and like you want to promote it, come back and just talk at me some more, because I've loved listening to you, man.
Love it. I appreciate it. Well, otherwise, in the meantime, you know, I do the slow drip while I've been trying to create healthy boundaries with social media. Nowadays, I'm more likely to simply pop in, say, Instagram, and drop a little thought bomb when I've got it. Ideally, adding value to the conversation or contributing, not as often, just like posting pictures of puppies or ranting about politics. So you and listeners can find me on Instagram at the Andrew Fraser, FRASER. And also at my website, which is fearfocusfreedom.com. And, you know, I love the work that you're up to, love the mission that a lot of your listeners are on. And for those who are interested or maybe kind of flirting with the edge and not sure how to push through that, then I'd be more than happy to chat with those folks too. So in fact, if they go to fearfocusfreedom.com/lovebombs, then I got a little extra offering for those guys. Be happy to chat a little bit more in person.
Well, I don't even know what that means, but I feel like that's related to this podcast, perhaps. So sorry, say again, fearfreedomfocus.com/love. I'll put a link in the show notes.
You got it. So my website is fearfocusfreedom.com. And if, you know, just as a thank you to you and listeners, if they were to go to fearfocusfreedom.com/lovebombs, we'll take them to a little different page where we're offering up a little bit of personal time and phone consultation for those who want a quick hit for some of these ideas to just launch them into the next step.
Yeah. Cause you do that. You're a coach, right? You do workshops and training. So if you're listening to this and you're like, I got to get more Andrew Fraser in my life, this dude sounds like someone that can help me out, hook him up, look him up, have a chat. One thing I try to perpetually reinforce to people is like, you lose nothing by having a free introductory call with a potential human that knows a lot of shit that might help you change your life. Like,
yeah.
Have the call. Like, I don't get it. Like, I've had a few guests now on here say like, yeah, you know, free call. My buddy Dan Harrison was another one who's a money coach, who's a genius. And I'm like, really, man? Free? So anyway, if you're listening, check him out. Follow him on Instagram. Brother, I have loved this conversation. Thank you very much for your time and for just being you, man. And do come back. My podcast is your podcast. If you ever want to come back and hang out some more.
Thank you, brother. It's been a joy to be hanging out in your living room together.
Yeah. And wait, you're based in Denver, you said? Boulder?
That's correct. Denver. And so for those, I'll leave this as well. For those who might be local in Denver, yeah. Another thing, an event that I host is actually a local storytelling event, similar to what I described with the moth. This I call Lean In Campfire Stories. So it's a little more exclusive in that we'll gather a small number of people in my backyard around an actual fire and hold space for humans to tell stories. No judging, scoring, or comparison. It's just an opportunity to share the collective human experience and connect with some other really extraordinary humans.
That's awesome. I want to go to that one day.
Yeah. But love to have you.
I'm crashing it. I don't care if I'm invited. I'm going to be coming.
consider the invitation permanent.
All right, brother. Thank you so much. And I will talk to you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jeremy.
See you, man.
Whew. Crazy conversation. Hey, what a wild and adventurous spirit this dude is. And how much wisdom he has in his soul. I loved it. And as he mentioned, if you want to book a free introductory coaching call with him, you can go to his website, fearfocusfreedom.com/lovebombs, and book that in. I'll include a link in the show notes. Ah, I love this conversation. I really did. I enjoyed that thoroughly. So I hope you did as well. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting me. Thank you for sharing this with people that you think might love it. Thank you for putting it in your Instagram stories and saying, gosh, Jeremy, you're so handsome. This really made a difference in my life. I appreciate that. I appreciate all of that. I just appreciate you. I take it very seriously that you're listening to my voice right now. And I just love you. I really do. You help my dreams come true. You help me make a positive impact in the world. Every listen counts. Every share counts. Thank you for being you. Keep kicking ass. Keep taking names. And keep being yourself. The world desperately needs you. Don't forget that.